Australian True Crime, the nation's leading independent true crime podcast, is hitting the road with our live show. We're coming to Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane this July, and tickets will be available starting May 10th at 9:30 a.m. sharp. They sold out in 2 hours last time, so do not dilly-dally. We know the suburbs of Australia are teeming with some of the most intriguing and chilling true crime stories the world has ever heard. Don't miss the chance to dive deeper and get involved with a live Q&A. With over 1.5 million downloads monthly, these tickets will sell out. So keep an eye on our social media pages and check the podcast bio for direct links to purchase yours as soon as they're released on Friday, May 10. I can't wait to see you there.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a true crime podcast, as the title suggests. So please consider this your warning that it's not suitable for children, and it probably will contain content that may be triggering to some people. Also, it's an Australian true crime podcast, so Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners should be aware it may contain the voices of deceased people.
The producers of this podcast recognise the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present and those emerging.
Homosexuality was not an offence itself. If you were homosexual and did nothing about it, you were fine. Homosexual acts were a capital offence. You could be hanged.
We are joined again by the host of one of my favourite podcasts, Forgotten Australia, Michael Adams. This time he brings us a truly heartbreaking case from Melbourne's Gold Rush heyday. As I record this, there are 65 jurisdictions around the world in which consensual gay sex is illegal, and 12 countries in which it's punishable by death. You can find more information about that at humandignitytrust.org. Although Australia is considered a youthful, progressive nation, we didn't begin decriminalising homosexual acts until 1975. First in South Australia, and finally in Tasmania in 1997. In today's Australian true crime, we're travelling back to the 1870s, when Melbourne was blossoming, shaking off her convict roots and making her mark on the world stage as a prosperous European-inspired capital. She could still be pretty inhospitable, though, for anyone who didn't fit the mould.
So it was actually the 5th of March. It was a really hot, hot day. They said that, you know, butter would run like honey. It was that hot. And the Treasury Gardens until quite recently had just been this wasteland. And over the past 5 years, it had been turned into the Treasury Gardens. We know this beautiful spot at the top end of town. And on that day, there was a gunshot out of the Treasury Gardens. A cop happened to be sort of, you know, in the neighborhood. He came running. Gardeners came running. And they found in this little glade two men, youngish men, laying 6 feet apart. One was on his back smoking a cigar. The other guy had his chest blown open and there was an unfired pistol between them. And obviously they were like, what happened here? And the guy who had the cigar said, we agreed to die together. He tried to shoot me, but could not. All will be explained. And the thing was that even though there was a trial to come, all would not be explained then. And we have a much better chance of sort of explaining and understanding it now, 150 odd years later, because we understand things like trauma. We understand, you know, how homosexual people were persecuted in colonial and in Federation Australia.
What sort of town was Melbourne in 1872? Like, were there many guns? Were there many shootings?
By 1872, Melbourne was well on the way to quote unquote marvelous Melbourne. The sort of wealth of the gold rush had been, you know, built upon over the past 20 years. A lot of the sort of beautiful colonial architecture we know was already standing. Top end of Collins Street was, you know, pretty much as it looks now in many respects. So it was a beautiful town. It had a large population. Crime had been really high in the 1850s and 1860s. It was less so in the 1870s, still high compared to, you know, today. And they were still hanging people, but not as frequently as they had previously.
Because I think it was about 1880, wasn't it? Around the 1880s when Melbourne was the most prosperous city in the world?
That's right, yeah. So Melbourne was well on its way to being, you know, marvellous Melbourne, being a place of wealth and opportunity. But those are all relative sort of terms. I mean, you know, there was still a lot of, you know, poverty. There was still a lot of degradation, violence. You know, Melbourne also had a real problem because it didn't have proper sewerage. It was known as Smelbourne, you know, so it was on its way, but there was still a long way to go. But it was a place that people had moved to because it did offer opportunities, you know, associated with the gold rush and the wealth that had built up around that.
I suppose if it's spending money on putting in a garden, putting in a huge, you know, parkland close to the city centre, I suppose that probably tells us that it's a pretty prosperous town, doesn't it? Even if it hasn't fixed its sewerage problem, it's built a garden.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, people like Sir Edmund Barry, whose statue is out the front of the State Library, was one of, you know, the leading citizens. And he's out the front of the State Library because that was one of his many projects. I mean, he was also the judge, who's obviously most famous for sending Ned Kelly to his death. But, you know, those kind of, you know, colonial gentlemen, the sirs, were trying to bring Melbourne up and make it into an international European city. I mean, they would have an international exhibition in Melbourne by 1879, 1880. So it was well on its way.
Mm. So we're not a federation yet, though. That happens in 1901.
Still a colony, still reporting to England. They're still the boss. But, you know, there is a distinct Australian identity. I mean, particularly the larrikins, they were on the rise in the late 1860s. And by the early 1870s, the word larrikin struck fear into a lot of people's hearts. It wasn't larrikins as we know it, like knock-around blokes. They were, you know, what we would call juvenile delinquents, young thugs on the street terrorising. And, you know, the big question was, what do we do with them? And the answer was, increasingly, let's flog the shit out of them. There was a very repressive sort of spirit, particularly amongst the judiciary, people like Sir Edmund Barry, Sir William Stawell, and other Supreme Court justices were increasingly in favour of bringing back the whip, the cat of nine tails, which had not been used in Victoria very much at all. So from the late 1860s, it was increasingly inflicted upon people, and it was inflicted on people for lesser and lesser offences, including sodomy.
Yeah, wow.
So it was a good time to be a white heterosexual male in Victoria.
Always a great time to be a white heterosexual man.
It was less of a good time to be anything else.
Yeah.
It was not a good time to be any sort of homosexual man in Victoria.
What were the laws around that and the punishment? So, I mean, I understand you can get a flogging for sodomy. What about chronic homosexuality? I mean, you know, I think we're sort of roughly around the time of some famous poets and writers and things in Victorian England who are going to jail. I'm thinking about Oscar Wilde for being sort of chronic homosexuals who just wouldn't give it up.
Homosexuality was not an offence itself. If you were homosexual and did nothing about it, you were fine. Homosexual acts were a capital offence. You could be hanged, and that was still on the books. So there had been people hanged in New South Wales in the 1820s for being homosexual acts, for sodomy. It hadn't happened in colonial Victoria, not, however, for lack of trying. So in 1863, there was a gentleman called John Wilson in Fitzroy who used to dress in women's clothing, called himself the Great Eastern, and was a sex worker. So for 18 months around Fitzroy, John Wilson, a.k.a. the Great Eastern, was taking clients back to his house to have sex with them, male clients. There was a sting operation. He was caught. He was arrested, searched, cavity searched, subjected to all sorts of indignities, including medical examination to establish that he was homosexual and had been breaking the law. All of his clients then turned against him, saying that they had been tricked and they had no idea he was a man, which was quite extraordinary. It was actually commented on the time how bizarre that these young men and older men had no idea they were having sex with another man. Anyway, he went to trial. It was a huge sensation in 1863. And the judge said, and this is Sir William Stawell, for whom Stawell was named, that no one had been hanged in Victoria for sodomy, but he was going to have a red hot go. And he sentenced him to death and said, you cannot depend on any reprieve. He wouldn't recommend to the executive that they commute the sentence to life in prison. The executive actually did. They gave John Wilson, for effectively being a sex worker, life in Pentridge, and he died 6 years later in jail. So it was effectively a death sentence. Had it been a woman convicted of, you know, working as a prostitute, as a sex worker, maybe 6 months, maybe 12 months in jail. Another case in 1870, and this was Sir Redmond Barry of Ned Kelly fame. This was a consensual homosexual act. This gentleman called Robert Morrison was convicted of. He gave him 11 years with hard labor, the first three in irons. So that means, you know, you've got chains around your legs and you have to shuffle around. But before that, 150 lashes. That was the maximum allowable sentence. They would be done in three sets of 50 over the space of 6 months. So you had time to really absorb the first 50 and then fear the next 50 and then fear the next 50 after that. And the newspapers said this was not sufficient enough. It wasn't severe enough. The newspapers gave blow-by-blow, and I'm talking literal blow-by-blow descriptions of this flogging. They loved it. They served it up. So this guy got, you know, 150 lashes for being gay, and then after that had a decade to look forward to in Pentridge. I actually used Ancestry to track what happened to him afterwards. He lived until 1917. He outlived all of them, and he died a, quote, respectable old bachelor in Yackandandah. And when I found that out, I kind of punched the air. It was like, good on you, mate. What a survivor. But as another contrast, in 1871 in Melbourne, a man, 22-year-old, used a claw hammer to bash his brother's brains in, drunk, in their house, in front of their younger brother, who said no stop after the first blow. This guy went to Redmond Barry's court. Redmond Barry directed the jury to find him guilty of manslaughter only. He then sentenced him to 4 years, of which he served 2.5. So weigh that up. You're in a consensual gay relationship. You get 10 years and 150 lashes. You kill your brother with a claw hammer and you do 2.5 years. That was sort of how justice was weighted at this time. And all of this is brought to bear on what happened in the Treasury Gardens, because I think what happened in the Treasury Gardens was a result of this sort of persecution of homosexuality in colonial Victoria.
How do you get done for homosexuality and for sodomy? Like,
sometimes it was the evidence of one person. someone says, I saw Joe over in the paddock doing something with Pete, and that would be enough. And the way it worked was usually the law would decide that one of the two involved, usually the younger one, had been led astray by the older one. So the younger one would then turn Crown evidence against the older one, either for a reduced or no sentence at all, and that would be enough to convict. So that guy who got the 150 lashes in the decade, he was convicted on the evidence of one person, and his partner got something like, you know, 18 months in jail because he was younger and considered to have been led astray.
And the penalties are so fearsome.
So fearsome. But it was also, this is the thing, there were very few prosecutions and very few trials and very few convictions simply because the actual terror of exposure, shame, all of it was so great that basically what they were saying was, if you're homosexual, keep it in the shadows. So if you were homosexual and you were, you know, an upper class fellow, a member of the Melbourne Club, if you did it behind closed doors and you could, you know, grease the right palms with bribes, if you happened to be suspected, you'd be fine. There was a case of a guy at the Melbourne Club who was arrested for sodomy, and they let him out on bail because he could get a whip around from all of his Melbourne Club mates to raise £100 bail. And then he just hopped in a carriage and took a leisurely drive up over the border and disappeared. If you were lower class and you were arrested, you didn't have that luxury. You didn't get bail. You awaited your trial and then you copped it. So, you know, these sentences of 150 lashes were not common, but that Robert Morrison guy was not the only one.
I mean, I feel compelled to say at this point that there are similar sentences being carried out around the world as we speak.
That's true.
I feel like my heart stops sometimes when you're talking, and I think it's happening right now to people around the world. So we have to remember that through each and every step. This is so sickening. So you're going to walk us through, and you've begun to walk us through one specific case, which again is helpful because it helps us to really consider ourselves in this case, in this situation, in this crazy sort of social situation. You know, imagining these are our brothers, these are our sons, yeah, because these are laws that we ultimately vote for and against. And these
are also laws that were only overturned in, you know, in living memory.
Yeah.
You know, homosexuality was a crime in many states until, you know, as recently as 20, 30 years ago. I think it's important, it's good to celebrate that this is no longer the case. It's also sort of important, I think, to remember how recently it was the case and how many lives were ruined in, you know, recent times by such persecution. I think we need to be vigilant. And you know, when in terms of like things like capital punishment in general, or you know, when people go, oh, you should bring back flogging, it's like, well, before you say something like that, have a look at what it was actually like and who got it and who dealt it. And yeah, I think if you can examine those things and really still be for capital punishment or some sort of torture, then yeah, I'd be surprised. I think it's often said by people who haven't really looked into it.
Yeah. And also the way that people can draw correlations when it suits them between things like homosexuality and pedophilia and things like that, which obviously there is no actual correlation, but when people get up and really going, they can start to, you know, we can get back into those dark ages. Edward Feeney and Charles Marx, who were these fellows? How did they meet? Who were they?
I went to the Public Records Office of Victoria, and there they have capital case files. Now, these are the original documents relating to trials that were capital, as in the outcome would be whether someone was put to death or not. So the capital case files were used to give to the executive, to the cabinet, and then possibly to the governor, so they could examine and determine whether the sentence should be carried out. It was basically a summary with transcripts of the trial evidence. The actual presiding judge would be there in the cabinet to guide them through it. So this file in the Public Records Office is the original document from 1872. In this document, I found one little reference that hadn't been reported at the time, and it was an address in Dublin. So it actually gave me a chance to look into the background of one of these men, and this was Edward Feeney, Ned Feeney. So he was born in Dublin in 1834, and his father, Andrew, he was a fancy bread man. He had a sweet shop. He sold cakes and fancy breads in Dublin, and they were middle class. So Ned got a bit of a pretty good education. His dad was a radical baker as well. So he was supporting Dan O'Connell, the activist protester who was trying to shrug off British rule. There's records of, you know, Andrew Feeney's support for these mass demonstrations, which were going to be met with gunfire by the British. So Dan O'Connell actually put a halt to them. These were like, you know, 500,000 people marches that would have been, you know, met with gunfire. So Dan O'Connell said, you know, rather than send my supporters to the slaughter, we'll call this one off. They were trying to shrug off the British rule, but then they had bigger things to worry about because the potato famine hit. All of a sudden in the newspapers, you see from 1845 onwards, reports that simply say, this person, this person, this person, and that person, all of the same family, quote, death by starvation. Over the next 7 years, Ireland's population went from 8.5 million to 5.5 million. So 1 million people starved to death or died from related illnesses. 2 million people emigrated. Hundreds of thousands of people were in the workhouses and forced to work on farms that were exporting food to England. So, you know, it was a terrible time for the Irish, and the country was forever changed by it. Now, we don't know. I couldn't find any other reference to Andrew Feeney's sweet bread shop after that period. So I think the chances are that they went bankrupt. There was a report of an Andrew Feeney arrested for begging in the streets in 1852. It was probably him. In any event, his son Ned got a job in the 1850s in a commercial house in London. And then in 1858, he left Ireland to join the 18th Royal Regiment. Now, the 18th Royal Regiment were legendary. They were part of the British Army, obviously formed by, you know, recruits from Ireland. They'd fought in the American War of Independence, the Opium Wars, the Crimean War, the Second Anglo-Afghan War, all those things we vaguely remember from history class. The 18th Royal Irish were there. In 1863, they had a new war. This was in New Zealand, and it was against the Maori. So for the past 20 years, the Maori resistance to white settlement had been sort of sporadic here and there, small battles. In the middle of 1863, it really stepped up. So they sent the Royal Irish as part of the reinforcements. Ned arrived in July of 1863 and pretty much stepped into the first bloodbath. It was the great battle called on the Great Southern Roads outside Auckland. 5 Royal Irish were killed that day, 11 were wounded. Sounds like a small skirmish by modern standards, but this is a really big deal. And the guys who died were hacked to pieces.
Oh, I was going to say, it doesn't sound soft or small or anything like that to me. And you're building a picture of a tough dude. Ned Feeney is a tough cat.
Well, I'm not sure how tough he is. He's certainly gone through 7 years of famine, and now he's about to go through 7 years of war. He's also fighting the Maori, who are being oppressed by the English, following exactly the same model that the Irish had been suppressed 100 years earlier, like exactly the same blueprint.
And he's fighting for the English, which is quite, it's got to be a very, you know, heavy on your heart.
A lot of Irishmen, even at the time, were reported as being quite conflicted. In March of 1864, the Royal Irish took on 300 Maori, and that included 100 women and children, at this massive battle over 3 days. 80 Maori were killed, 17 of the Royal Irish were killed and 51 wounded. So we're talking another bloodbath. And there were further such battles for Ned over the next couple of years. By 1870, the Royal Irish were being recalled. So they were he was going to be discharged. A lot of Royal Irish actually stayed in New Zealand and settled there. Others were sent to Australia, where they would then transit to back to England. He decided to stay, so he moved to Melbourne. So he moved down to Melbourne around August of 1870. Now, he's had the trauma of the famine. He's had the trauma of the war. He's 36 years old. He served in the Royal Irish, who are considered to be absolute heroes. So he's got good character references. He gets a job at Melbourne Hospital as a wardsman. Now, Melbourne Hospital was by this stage huge. It was on the corner of Swanston and Lonsdale Streets. It had about 360, 370 people in the hospital at any one point, patients. It was as good as hospitals could get at the time, but disinfectant was in its absolute infancy. There were no antibiotics. Anesthetics were also really in their infancy. So in 1869, for instance, there were 3,335 inpatients at Melbourne Hospital, 468 died. So if you went into hospital for any condition, you had a 1 in 5 chance of not coming out. So Ned was a wardsman. His job, he lived in quarters in the hospital, was to transport patients, pick up soiled linen, soiled bandages, take them to be disposed of or washed, to carry bone saws and other surgical equipments from surgical theatres to be washed, etc. He also, of course, took dead people to the morgue so that the doctors could, you know, perform autopsies and so on. So I think any way you cut it, I mean, you know, he was supposedly very good at his job, very polite, etc. This is trauma. He's seeing dead people, dying people, suffering people pretty much every day. He's also living in a colony now where he's well aware that a guy's just been flogged, gotten 150 lashes for being gay, and Ned is a homosexual man. So that is, I think, this constant background pressure that at any moment, you know, well, you either can't live your life the way you want to, or if you do, you risk being tortured and possibly killed. Not to mention just everyday persecution by people who might suspect that you're gay.
Also, Irish people weren't that welcome.
No.
So, yeah, it's a pretty unwelcome world he's living in.
Yeah. So my theory is that he was suffering from post-traumatic stress. I mean, you know, obviously it hadn't been named at that point, but it still happened. It still occurred. And his mental state would certainly, I think, bear out that suggestion. In any event, in February of 1871, there was a new assistant wardsman at Melbourne Hospital. Now, his name was Charlie Marks. He was about 25 or 26. All we know about him, I couldn't find anything much more about him. He had been at sea. What we do know from photographs at the time was that he was a very handsome dude. So these two became inseparable. They both lived in the quarters in the Melbourne Hospital. Both of them had no family on this side of the world, and they had few other friends. So they worked together. They had quarters in the same area of the Melbourne Hospital. And when they weren't working, they spent all of their time together. They used to go to Abe Risco's wine bar. If anyone wants to visit it, it's at 245 Bourke Street in Melbourne, probably no longer there. So Bourke Street in Melbourne at this point was, you know, really raucous, pubs, restaurants, theatres. And the big attraction was the Waxworks with its Chamber of Horrors. Now, the Chamber of Horrors was regularly refreshed because they would use phrenological molds to make effigies of murderers, dress them in their own clothes with their own weapons. People would pay good money to come and see them. So that was Bourke Street. But Abe Briscoe's wine bar was a pretty quiet joint, and Ned and Charlie were pretty quiet customers. They'd go in there, they'd have a few wines, they'd talk to each other, they'd talk to Abe and his wife, and then they would get back to the hospital before the 10 p.m. curfew. But even at the time, it was noticed, quote, this is the Daily Telegraph in Melbourne, said they had, quote, a friendship so strong it was noticeable to the most casual observers, and the strangest bond of affection was their greatest peculiarity. So I think if it was that obvious to casual observers, it was quite obvious to someone like Abe, who saw them all the time in his wine bar, that these guys were more than just friends. So things went bad by February of 1872. They were both depressed, melancholy. I think it was probably because they had this relationship that they had to keep secret. In any event, Charlie resigned from the hospital and got a job on a ship called the Edina, which would go from Melbourne to Warrnambool and back, take passengers, and that return journey would take about 3 days. So he was going to be a steward. He'd live on board, and when he wasn't voyaging, he'd be back in Melbourne and he'd be able to see Ned. But they weren't going to be living together. They weren't going to be working together. 2 days after Charlie took this job, Ned tried to kill himself in Melbourne Hospital with chloroform. Now, he nearly succeeded.
I wonder why. I know you can't answer me this question, but, I mean, they had a partnership. They had a relationship.
I think, you know, Ned was probably traumatised by all the things he'd seen and was still seeing on the hospital. And I think also the relationship with Charlie was quite tumultuous. They wrote letters to one another, which were then later made public, in which Charlie seemed to be more attached to Ned then vice versa. Ned seemed to be in two minds about living, for one, because he also said he was going to try again, but also about Charlie. It seemed like he was trying to break things off or couldn't actually reconcile himself to being with Charlie. So in mid-February, after one of these trips on the Adena, Charlie came back to meet Ned at the wine bar, and Ned wasn't there. And he said to Abraham, the owner, I think he's probably going to go and kill himself. I'm going to go and try and find him. If I don't come back, that means I've killed myself too. Charlie was saying, he had said in letters, if you kill yourself, I won't be long for this world either. So please don't. Let's try and work something out. He wanted Ned to come and work with him on the ship. Ned said, I can't. The hospital's been so good to me since my incident, which, you know, the hospital actually took Charlie's word that his chloroform overdose had been accidental. It clearly hadn't been, and they said so later. Now, the thing with attempting suicide at the time was, if they'd reported it, he would have had to go before a magistrate and have, you know, his mental state assessed, because committing suicide and trying to commit suicide was a crime as well. The penalty was usually incarceration in a lunatic asylum.
Oh.
I mean, they didn't prosecute people and put them in jail for it, that I've found, by this stage at least.
But the lunatic asylum was a very, very bad option.
Around the bend to Yarra Bend Lunatic Asylum, exactly. So the hospital took him at his word that he'd accidentally taken all this chloroform. He was in like his sickbed for like 4 or 5 days. He was really almost dead. The thing was, of course, he was still living in the hospital. So for all intents and purposes, they could keep him under observation. They did keep him under observation, and he was deteriorating. He'd been a relatively sober sort of chap. Now he was drinking a lot, to the point where at the end of February, they had to sack him. So at the end of February, Ned, who's, you know, had this great character reference, having been in the Royal Irish and so forth, is out of a job. He's also out of a home. Charlie comes back from the Adena. They stay in a hotel room together. Charlie's due back on the ship on Tuesday, and he doesn't turn up. So he has also now lost his job and also will have a bad character reference. So they've kind of crossed a line at this point. The night before, they were in Abraham's wine bar, and Charlie said, I wonder what time the Treasury Gardens closes. And he said, oh, I have an appointment there. And he said, well, I think it closes at about 8, so it's probably closed by now. And Ned said, who do you have an appointment with? And he said, well, I have an appointment there with you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The next day, they went to William Davies' photographic studio in town. They came in, they'd been drinking a little, they weren't drunk, but they were, you know, affected by alcohol, it was obvious, and they asked to have photos made. Now, these were little postcard side photos. Usually they would be, you know, one person per picture or people sitting side by side. They wanted to pose with pistols. They had two horse pistols, which are big guns. And the photographer was kind of like, oh, okay, like bushrangers. So why don't you, you know, take off your tie, take off your jacket, stand there, you know, typically a shot like that, they'd be pointing their guns towards the camera. They stood facing one another with the guns pointed at each other's hearts, resting at each other's hearts. After that, they had another photograph taken where they were holding hands and staring at each other's eyes. Now, these are astounding photographs. They paid for them and said they'd be back to, well, they put down a deposit and said they'd be back to pick them up in a few days. They knew they were never coming back to collect those photographs. Those photographs weren't for them. They were for us. They were testimony about what they intended to do. They went to Abe's wine bar after this directly. They got some paper. They went into the back room and they started to write letters. Now, Abe's would say that he thought Charlie was standing over Ned telling him what to write. Abe would also say a bunch of stuff that seemed geared to make Ned seem not gay, that Charlie was the gay one and that Ned had been trying to get away from him. There's a little bit of evidence to support that earlier on, but the most recent letters seem to be that they had actually reached a place where they were together, but also had decided that they would leave this world together.
So Ned, just to cover off on that, Ned was the elder of the two?
Ned was 36 and Charlie was about 10 years younger.
Yeah, yeah. But Ned was the man who'd been through a lot of trauma to get there?
Yeah. They had something to eat. Ned had bought a mourning ring. Now, that is mourning. It was a very common thing back in the day. You'd sometimes have a little inscription on it. It might even have an image. And it was a mourning ring that you would buy to mourn somebody. He'd bought one for himself and for Charlie. He then tried to give it to Abe's wife. There was a bit of a kerfuffle over this. She was a bit creeped out by this. And he actually said, you can have it inscribed to in memory of EF and CM, Edward Feeney and Charles Marx. They were getting a bit spooked at this stage. They were also certainly spooked when Ned pulled out his horse pistol and aimed it at the roof. And Abe was like, what the hell? And Charlie was like, hey, put that away. And Ned was like, you know, I've been in the army. I know how to handle guns. Don't worry about it. He put the gun away, but Abe noticed that Charlie also had a pistol. Then they said their goodbyes and Ned said, I'll see you soon, to Abe. And Charlie said, no, you won't. And they left. Abe and his wife then went into the back room and found the letters they'd left. Charlie had written a letter to his mother, which was a suicide letter, saying, we're both about to be dead. Anything that you're going to leave to me, give to my sister. Goodbye. Abe ran out into the street, saw a cop and said, there's two men going to the Treasury Gardens. I think they're about to do something terrible. And the cop said, I can't leave my beat, not my problem. Go to the detective office. So Abe ran to the detective office. They pretty much had the same attitude, but they did say they'd send somebody to have a look. Bang, a shot rings out from the top end of town. And they go into the gardens and they find Ned Feeney smoking a cigar, Charlie lying dead. So who'd shot who? The only gun was an unfired horse pistol laying between them on the grass. So they said, what happened to Ned? And he said, he was meant to shoot me. He couldn't do it. All will be explained. And they were like, well, what happened to you? Because he's got a hole in his coat as well. And his hand's bloodied. And they say, there was only one gun here. It's unfired. Where's the other one? He said, must be around here somewhere. And they find it in a little creek just a few feet away. And it was blown to pieces. So what had happened was the men had pointed their guns at each other. They'd overstuffed them with powder. I guess it was the count of three. Charlie didn't fire, couldn't fire. Ned did. His gun exploded in his hand, killed Charlie, but also a piece of the gun flew back, pierced his own coat, and was found in his coat. So he was taken from the gardens, and they made a big deal of the fact that he was smoking his cigar coolly. There are other reports that say he was basically affected by alcohol or in shock, and the cigar was just in his mouth. But the idea was that he'd gunned down his friend coolly. Now, he was charged with murder. They did an autopsy on Charlie, a guy, one of the most ghoulish characters in Australian history, Dr. Edward Barker, who was known as the Hanging Doctor because he was so fascinated by executions. He was also fascinated by homosexuality. So he did an autopsy on Charlie to establish that he was a homosexual man.
Right, okay.
Right?
Yep.
Charlie was dead. Ned was taken into custody, put into Melbourne jail. He was going to stand trial for murder. The legal opinion was that suicide was illegal. So even if he hadn't shot his friend, he'd helped him to commit suicide. If they'd both gone out to shoot themselves, he was still a party to that. So he was still guilty of that anyway. Any way you cut it, he was going to be convicted.
He's going to go somewhere, either jail or round the bend.
The only defense would be insanity. Now, despite Ned having said in the immediate aftermath, all will be explained, he didn't say a goddamn word, nothing, to nobody. So there was an inquest. He was committed to stand trial. He was in Old Melbourne Jail, which was at that time the governor was John Buckley Castillo, who would be Ned Kelly's last friend. John Buckley Castillo kept a diary at this point. So we have entries in his diary about this case, which was a sensation because the police talked to the newspaper reporters. Abraham Briscoe talked to the newspaper reporters. The letters were tended in evidence in the inquest. They were published in full in the newspapers. So, you know, you didn't have to read too far between the lines to realize what had happened here, that these homosexual men had entered into this mutual death pact. One of them hadn't managed to kill the other, and he was now about to be tried. So it was a massive sensation in terms of publicity, in terms of coverage. But because Ned wouldn't say anything, his defender in the trial, Hickman Molesworth, had to mount an insanity defense without him actually having submitted to medical examination to establish whether he was sane or not. So it was all sort of circumstantial in terms of, you know, how he'd acted before, previous, you know, his previous suicide attempt, all of the rest of it. Now, as I said, you know, if the hospital authorities had said this guy tried to commit suicide a month earlier, he would have been examined and likely found to be insane and not responsible for his actions. If he'd succeeded, the inquest would have said died while laboring under insanity. That was typically what a suicide inquest verdict was, that you killed yourself because you were not in your right mind. But the Crown would not accept the idea that these two men had been insane, at least on the point of suicide, when they'd gone into the gardens. They'd gone there, they said, to commit cross murder rather than, I guess, mutual suicide. The initial reports in the newspaper, though, across the board, all said that this was believed to be a case of suicidal mania on the part of both men. In the trial, however, because Feeney would not talk at all, the defense was very restricted in what they could actually present as evidence. They could present a lot of conjecture, a lot of argument, but not much in the way of evidence at all, and certainly nothing from a medical opinion. Also, it wasn't like they could raise the homosexual angle in the slightest. To do so wouldn't help a jury. It wouldn't make a jury be more merciful. It would have the absolute opposite effect. And the prosecution sort of said, you know, well, we can't guess at the motives for this, but what were they, kind of thing? And they also, what they posited was that Ned had wanted to flee from Charlie and had actually taken this opportunity to murder him. So their theory was that they'd come up with this murder-suicide plan, and Ned had thought, ha, here's my opportunity. I'll just blow him away before he has a chance to shoot me. Okay, but why would you do that in broad daylight in the Treasury Gardens after having taken a photograph of yourself holding a gun at the guy and having written letters to this effect that you were going to kill yourself? So that made absolutely no sense. So the judge, Edward Williams, Now, he, in 1855, had recorded a death sentence against a guy for sodomy. Now, recording a death sentence was not the same as sentencing someone to death. It was acknowledging that this was a capital crime. You'd been found guilty of it. I'm going to sentence you to death, but I know I'm going to record a death sentence, but I know that it's going to be overturned. Nevertheless, he was no friend to any homosexual man. He directed the jury that they were not to consider an insanity defense. So they could find, if the question was, had Ned Fernie pulled the trigger? If he had, he was guilty of murder. If he hadn't, and Charlie had somehow managed to shoot himself, which was one of the theories put forward, Ned might still be guilty because he'd aided and abetted Charlie's suicide. So the jury was to deliberate for all of 15 minutes, and they found that Ned Fernie was guilty of murder. Now, this was an automatic death sentence, and the judge said that he would not recommend mercy. The jury didn't recommend mercy. The judge also said, before he actually sentenced him to death, that you were a coward. What you should have done was you should have picked up the pistol that Charlie had dropped and you should have blown your brains out. Now, this was a judge of the Supreme Court telling a man he was about to sentence to death that he should have committed the crime of suicide. This actually came in for a lot of criticism. It was like, this is beyond the pale for a judge to say this from the bench. You might think it, but you shouldn't say it. The judge wouldn't back down. He wouldn't apologize. In the capital case file, he reiterated he faced absolutely no censure for this. Ned did not say a word. Sentenced to death, he didn't even react. He remained absolutely passive the whole way through. Now, I think he did this because it was the last vestige of dignity he had. If he actually tried to defend himself, if he admitted anything, it would only increase his shame and it would do no good whatsoever. So I really admire the fact that he didn't say anything. Now, as the execution date approached, it was the 14th of May, 1872, a letter arrived for Ned, and it was from his mum in Ireland. Now, because of the times involved in letters getting to and from Melbourne and Dublin, she had no idea that any of this had happened. So she was just writing to her son. He got the letter in jail, and he now said, because he'd previously said he didn't even need a pen and paper, he now said he wanted a pen and paper, and he wrote a letter back to his mother, the contents of which he asked to be kept private, and they were. And then he said to Castillo, I need to tell you that what they've said about me and Charlie is not true. Charlie and I were not involved. He was pestering me. I was trying to get away from him. I am heterosexual, not homosexual. I want you to tell the press. And Castillo did. So what I think happened here was the letter from his mother had kind of reminded him that eventually Ma is going to find all of this out.
Yes.
It's going to make the papers back home.
Catholic Ma back in Ireland.
Yeah, at least I can put it on the record, give her something to hang on to, that I might have been a murderer, but I wasn't gay.
Oh, God.
The thing was as well that this was the only thing he said. He didn't say anything. He didn't deny anything else. He didn't say he hadn't shot Charlie, anything. He was more concerned with not being thought of as being homosexual than being thought of as a murderer.
Well, I suppose that leaves me in a position now to ask, what makes you think he was? Because just from the conversation we've had, which is only, you know, less than an hour about this man's entire life, in your research, yeah, what makes you think that he was gay?
Well, the content of the letters, and the letters are quite lengthy. I think from memory, four of them are from Charlie to Ned. Two of them are from Ned to Charlie, but both of them reference other letters that weren't entered into the public domain. I presume that they were lost, so that we get a hint of the other letters by what they're discussing. And it's possible that they were only platonic friends. The content of the letters makes it seem very, very unlikely. Certainly at the time, everybody believed they were homosexual.
Yeah.
I leave it open. But I think it's almost certainly the case.
We can definitely make assumptions about the two middle-aged, one middle-aged guy and the younger guy who hung out together at the wine bar constantly, who were never married, never spent time with women, who were in this incredibly close friendship, so close that other people commented and went, God, they're so close.
Would you like me to read a little bit of one of the letters?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Okay, just stand by. So this is a letter from Charlie to Ned. I want you to know if you like me well enough to accede to the proposal I make, that is to remain fast friends, not friends today or tomorrow, but forever. I do not attempt to deny, but I am proud to say I love you as a brother and perhaps more, for I don't know a brother's love, never having had one, and I know you are fond of me, or at least I hope you are. Ned, we are both getting old enough to look out for the future, so I want us not ever to part. I am, as I told you before, expecting at the death of my poor old mother about £800 to £1,000, but in what way I am to receive it, I cannot say, but when I know, you shall know also. Of course, when we have sufficient to start business with, we will, that is, if you intend to be the friend I desire, which I sincerely hope you do, but think, Ned, if you like me well enough for that, I hope you do. If I go home, you come. If you go, I come with you. But we neither have many friends we care much for. I think we might do far worse than be united in close brotherhood. If, as I said before, you can without any scruple say yes, do. I shall be waiting in dread for fear of no. Answer this in the same manner by writing, hoping, please God, you accede to my proposition, which I'll close, and believe me to remain your sincere friend until death do us part. I mean every word and more than is here written. Yours, Charlie. Now, I mean, until death does part us, sorry, was the actual wording. It's basically a reworded marriage vow. And also you've got to remember that these letters, if they contained anything that was obvious, this would be evidence against them if that was found. It would be enough to hang them.
Yeah, it feels like a coded proposal, doesn't it?
Yeah. Now, Ned did write back and say, my dear Charlie, I have at last come to the conclusion to answer your letter, and I dare say you will brand me one of the most deceitful beings in existence. He basically said, I knew I would have to separate from you and I did not like to mention it. But a later letter on the 27th of February, so this is 6 days before they went to the Treasury Gardens, Charlie wrote, my dear Ned, I was glad you got in all right last night. Not that I should be very glad for you to leave, but I should like you to leave on your own account. He's talking about getting back into the hospital after they've been drinking. He didn't want him to get fired for being drunk. It appeared that Ned had been talking about suicide again because Charlie wrote, now, as you are my friend, don't do anything of the sort. If you do, I shall not remain long. Now, this is what Charlie had written in response to what Ned had said. Ned, now I know the reason of your determination and that we are what, by the blessing of God, we shall remain true to the core. I feel happy and shall sail today with a light heart. And then talking about having just left each other that morning, fancy the good reception we gave each other in the morning and then at night, and that you and I are the same as before. Ned, for my sake, don't do anything to yourself. So this sounds very much to me like they'd been trying to work out what their relationship was and had decided that they actually were going to be together. It's not 100%, but I think it's much stronger evidence of them being homosexual than heterosexual.
Yeah. And also, so if I can go back then to Abe, the bar owner, saying to the police, was it, that no, Ned wasn't gay, Charles was pressuring him?
He didn't say, no one said anything as outright as that. They wouldn't actually say outright that Ned was homosexual. I mean, it was strongly hinted in the wording, but to actually say it without him being charged and convicted for it would be libel, would be slander. So you couldn't say that lightly. What Abe did say was that they were intensely friendly. He did say that, you know, on that last day, Charlie had been nuzzling Ned, had Ned's head in his lap, had been kind of cuddling him, trying to kiss him, stuff like that, and that Ned had been sort of awkward and, you know, not resistant, but awkward about it, uncomfortable about it.
So do you think he was trying to defend Ned because by that stage Ned was fighting murder rap?
Absolutely. Abe did not want his bar to be known as a gay bar, I believe, and he also wanted to, as much as was possible, defend Ned against any insinuation that he was homosexual or that, you know, he'd been in a consensual relationship of a physical nature with Charlie. That's the, I think, the most likely interpretation. I mean, it could be that they were heterosexual and Charlie had just got the wrong idea, but I don't think the letters support that. I think they actually support the other conclusion. No matter what Ned then said, I think Ned was saying that for his mother's benefit, because otherwise he would have said it earlier. He would have said it at trial. He would have said it at numerous other opportunities.
Also, I mean, again, you know, to put things into context, these were the laws in Australia at the time, but my gosh, Dublin was a whole other level of homophobia and Irish Catholic mum.
This would have given her something to hang on to that, you know.
Well, the idea of her getting the news later on that, you know, your son has been put to death and these were the rumours and this was the story going around would have been heartbreaking for him.
Well, the story actually broke in the English papers around about the same time he went to the gallows. But the story that went that she was reading was that he was had been arrested for murder and was on trial. So she didn't know and wouldn't know for another few months that he'd actually been hanged. And that letter would have arrived at the same time as those newspapers, or maybe just ahead of them. So she would have had his version first. You know, I guess it would have said something like, you know, you'll probably hear a lot about me. Don't believe it. It's not true, etc. So on the 14th of May in Old Melbourne Jail, Ned went to the gallows. He was tended to by William Bamford. William Bamford was the one-eyed drunken hangman who'd been in the job for 15 years. And as usual, he made a mess of it. Ned struggled for about 3 minutes before he was still. John Buckley Castillo, the governor of Melbourne Jail, who was there, wrote in his diary, "Feeney seemed to struggle much longer than men who are hanged usually do." The hanging doctor, Edward Barker, was right there. And Castillo said, "What's up with that?" And Dr. Barker couldn't answer that, despite being an expert supposedly on hanging. Then Dr. Barker, once Ned was cut down, and this is strong stuff, so listeners be advised, took the body to be autopsied. Castillo said that Barker and his medical students, quote, reveled in the luxury of a fresh and healthy corpse. What they really wanted to do was check out the rectum. They wanted to see if it showed signs of homosexual activity. And yes, Dr. Barker concluded that it did. There were signs of a, quote, vicious indulgence. Now, modern medical science says this is absolutely junk. This is proves nothing either way. Dr. Barker turned to John Buckley Castillo and said, "What do you think of this rectum? Does it show signs of a vicious indulgence?" And John Buckley Castillo, in his diary, wrote, "I had no experience of what a healthy rectum would represent." So he declined to give his opinion. Castillo clearly thought Barker was a disgusting individual. But, you know, it was a little industry. So poor old Ned had his beard and hair cut off by the hairdresser slash phrenologist, Joseph Doubleday, who then took the mold of his head. And Ned got to rejoin Charlie in the waxworks, his effigy having his own hair and beard. So he ended up being an attraction on Bourke Street right near a Briscoe's wine bar. So, you know, I think the conclusion is that, you know, given that the judge could have interpreted the evidence in a entirely different way, could easily have decided that, you know, an insanity defense could be presented just on, he could have allowed the jury the option of a verdict of insanity. Juries were actually pretty reluctant to convict in capital cases because they didn't want someone's death on their hands. In this case, they may have gone with an insanity verdict and Ned may have been, you know, released after 5 years or 10 years. As we discussed earlier, a guy had bashed his brother to death, gotten a manslaughter verdict and been out in two. So this seemed to me to be a case where they hadn't been able to hang someone previously for being gay, but this certainly, I think, played into this verdict and this execution. So a real tragedy.
It's so interesting to look back. That's what I love about your show, and I've said this to you before, to look back on these stories through the lens that we have now, where to us we go, well, this guy's obviously carrying so much trauma by this stage, and then he happens to be gay and in this time and this place where that's a traumatic, frightening situation, and he meets this younger man, Charles, who's a bit more, I guess, confident with it or a bit more likely to just say, fuck it, let's just go for it. Like, you know, as younger people tend to be, but also Charlie doesn't have that trauma and that fear, I don't think.
Not that we know of. I mean, we don't know his background, so it's possible. And we don't necessarily know 100% that Ned was traumatized, but, you know, he had tried suicide. He was drinking heavily. He was anxious. He was described as being melancholy, worried.
He's lived through one of the most traumatic historical events.
That's right.
You know, that we know of. And in Charlie's letter that you've read, you know, Charlie's literally proposing, let's do this. I want to live the rest of my life with you. Let's find a way.
Ned is also suicidal.
Yeah.
And Ned is going to commit suicide. And Charlie has said, if you go, I'm coming with you. And they decided that that's what they would do.
And they did.
And I mean, the irony of that must have been just devastating for Ned while he's in jail. I mean, you know, he would have been prepared to go and commit suicide by himself.
Yep.
Charlie has said, let's do this. And Charlie's ended up out of this world. Ned has ended up with his whole life exposed in the Melbourne and colonial press. All around Australia, this was a big story. Everybody saying that he's homosexual. Everybody saying that he's a murderer. It's a foregone conclusion that he's going to be hanged. Then he's going to be dissected. Then he's going to be in the waxworks. The only dignity he's got left, the only control over anything he has left, is to say nothing. And he exercises that. Doesn't say anything, doesn't give them any more ammunition to use against him, knows that trying to mount any sort of defense is going to be absolutely pointless and just increase his shame. So he doesn't. An incredibly tragic story. And I think it does remind us of, you know, why laws that discriminate and persecute people for nothing have to be resisted at every point. I have one coming up. It's in 1945 in Brisbane, and it's again about a massive miscarriage of justice due to police homophobia. And in this case, their homophobia meant that their investigation into a homicide went in entirely the wrong direction, which allowed the killer to strike again. This one's based on a 1,000-page police file. So this is the inside workings of this investigation. And you actually see that they had the name of the killer and they didn't look at it twice because they already had made their mind up that it was a gay murderer. So, yeah, that one's coming up on the podcast. So it'll be a few weeks. But in the meantime, there's a whole bunch of other murder cases up because this current season is all about crimes that shocked Australia. So
fantastic. Forgotten Australia. Not forgotten by you, mate.
Bless you. Not forgotten by you either. Thank you, Michelle. I really appreciate it.
Thank you to our guest, Michael Adams from Forgotten Australia. And if you'd like to know more about Ned Feeney and Charlie Marks, you can head over to Forgotten Australia, where there's a four-part series all about them. If you need support after listening to this podcast, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Or contact 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732 or 1-800-RESPECT.org.au. Indigenous Australians can contact 13 Yarn on 13-92-76 or 13yarn.org.au. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Australian True Crime, the nation's leading independent true crime podcast, is hitting the road with our live show. We're coming to Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane this July, and tickets will be available starting May 10th at 9:30 a.m. sharp. They sold out in 2 hours last time, so do not dilly-dally. We know the suburbs of Australia are teeming with some of the most intriguing and chilling true crime stories the world has ever heard. Don't miss the chance to dive deeper and get involved with a live Q&A. With over 1.5 million downloads monthly, these tickets will sell out. So keep an eye on our social media pages and check the podcast bio for direct links to purchase yours as soon as they're released on Friday, May 10. I can't wait to see you there.